out. In fact, a lot of people assumed best you could get are segregated networks with very thin pipes in between them, you know, with a lot of restrictions. And the IETF didn't believe that. They really did believe it is extremely like how we are today. I will keep coming back. So I will alternate between how the IETF works, why it does it. But for some organizations, you don't really need to know why they exist. They obviously exist to money or to promote something. It's sort of important to understand that the folks who started the IETF really were ideological. They were nerds. Were a bunch of technologists doing this. But it was with ideological bent because the idea of a single internet just, you know, a lot of people said, nah, never happened. And yet it has. So this is a good description, common things you'll see it on T-shirts around the IETF, of we reject kings, presidents, and voting. We believe, this is still widely true, even though this is a 5, maybe even 30-year-old quote. But the we reject kings and presidents and voting. So kings meaning someone comes in and says, well, I'm an important person in some, you know, government or I own such and such, and I'm going to tell you what to do. And, you know, that happens occasionally at IETF meetings, and mostly people just laugh at it because it's like, no, we don't care about that. We care about the technology. How do you make technology work like this? Well, some organizations make it work by having voting and everyone free or whoever has the most money gets the votes to happen. The IETF actually has always been fairly averse to that. And I'll talk more about rough consensus later, but also running code is something very important to the IETF. You have a new idea, you come to the IETF, and you say, we should all do this. One way to prove that you've actually thought this through is to actually have, you don't have to. And in fact, sometimes the IETF goes ahead on ideas without an implementation. Later do the implementation and go, oops, that's actually not as good of an idea as we thought. One of the things that I also want to emphasize here is about rough consensus. That's in make decision. But there's also rough consensus that, so the IETF is one of the best organizations at admitting, lots of organizations won't do that. In fact, they'll throw money at trying to prevent you noticing that they screwed up. The IETF actually revises their documents often. And that also takes rough consensus. One of the best things that happens in the IETF is when someone stands up, 2 years ago I wrote this document and you all standardized and stuff like that. I didn't really mean that, you know. Or now we need to revise that. And that will also take rough. Some other people will have already started following and made it their favorite thing. And so the IETF is very big about this kind of rough consensus evolution, fragile. People would make a point, they would solidify the mistake, you know, they would add layers to stake, and then everything would fall apart. The IETF is good at looking at what has happened in the past and going, let's try something different. So bullet points here. So the RFC explains exactly what the IETF is. By the way, it's the RFC that I wrote. Bullet points are the important parts. Everyone is, and there's a bunch of people sitting here in front of me. You don't have to raise. All of you can be IETF participants. And I mean that not just like that you're invited to participate, but the barrier to IETF is approximately as low as it can be. Namely, if you can subscribe to a mailing list, you're an IETF participant. Even if you say anything, the fact that you're reading what's going on literally makes you an IETF. There is no membership in the IETF. You cannot become a member of the IETF. And some participants spend 99% of their time reading documents. They're a little bit afraid of saying anything because there are plenty of participants who talk all the time. Wide range. But it's important to understand that because there is almost no barrier to being a participant, it's going to be an extremely wide community, wide internationally. And that's been true since the IETF meeting. There were, even though a lot of people, always been international. It's not like that it was a U.S. organization 5 years into it said, we'd better reach out. There's been very active participation from Europeans and Asians since day one, partially because it started off with a general, especially in computer science, are a more international. But in addition, because this was about one of the most interesting research topics in the 80s, well, if you hop over an ocean, how does that work? You know, aren't there going to be latent? So it has always been an international organization. One of the other things that pull out is that if you join the IETF, if active in it, You are doing it as an individual. Even though you're from a company or an organization or a government or whatever, you stand up and say, hi, I'm from blah, blah, blah. Most people won't even listen. They care about you. They care about your previous contributions. If you've had good contributions, you'll get listened to more than if you've had dumb ones. But the company you work for has a little bit of relevance, but almost none. And one of the ways that we see this often in the IETF is some companies have literally dozens of people who are active in the IETF, such as Cisco, the large router vendor. And you will sit in a meeting where someone makes a proposal, maybe even someone from Cisco makes a proposal, and other people from Cisco are like, no, 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 this is all wrong. And then, you know, so it's not like there's a Cisco voice or a United States government voice or whatever. Some people expect there to be, because that's what we're used to in our normal life. In the IETF, that just gets blown apart. You really are there as you. So the other thing that's... So a lot of people don't actually understand that ICANN sort of came out of the IETF. It's not like a split off of the IETF, but ICANN itself, the people who got ICANN formed were mostly IETF people. So a lot of the things that ICANN does, like having 3 meetings a year, lots of remote participation and such, follow what the IETF was doing. So there is a lot of remote participation in the IETF. One thing to... So now we're being recorded... Do I need to say all that other stuff again? No, no, no. What? Oh, okay. So let's talk a little bit about rough consensus, because this is sort of the second weird the IETF does. Imagine if you had started an organization where there's actually no formal membership anyone could be in. You know, and really, it's who's on a mailing list. You can't even tell who's reading the mail and such like that. And you said, let's have a vote. How are you going to count votes? You don't even know who's, you know, you don't even know who's participating. And so the IETF, as a reaction to this, was like, great, we aren't going to vote. We're going to base this all on rough consensus. And remember, I had that before. We believe in rough consensus and running code. The nice thing about rough consensus is it absolutely does not require unanimity, but it also doesn't even require a majority. In some IETF working groups, some of the work that's being done is really minute and boring to most of the people in the room. So when that work is done, all you need is somebody saying, who is, you know, do we have rough consensus that this is probably good enough? People don't all have to say, yes, I've read it and such like that, because let's face it, most people are lying when you ask those kind of questions. People who come up and say, I've read it and I like it, or I've read it and I don't like it, I have these issues. That's how you get rough consensus. It's not really not counting. And in this process, you obviously will have disputes. You know, we're a bunch of engineers. We're going to have very strong opinions about very minute things. But you solve that through discussion, not through voting, not through coercion. And if you're interested in this idea, because I know some folks here are probably from the policy arena or just the social arena, the last RFC, and I'll explain how to look at RFCs later, is actually how a description of how we do rough consensus. Really interesting. And I say interesting in the sense of it's not what most people are familiar with in their day-to-day lives. Certainly not in most organizations that we work in. So this is a recap on where we come from. So there's two things. There's our process getting there, but there's also the fact that what the IETF produces are open standards. And, you know, we hear about open this, open source software and such. IETF was really one of the first ones to actually use the word open and mean it, like in the mid-80s even. So open standards means a couple of things. One is that they were produced openly. Anyone could have participated in creating that standard. The other is that, let's say that you're talking about a standard that already exists, such as the DNS. Anyone has access to the technical standards for the DNS. They're copyrighted, but they are freely distributed. RFCs are one of the most widely distributed publications in the world. People reproduce them all the time. Some people do translations. So it's very easy to get access to it. But the other thing that makes it open is no one is forced to use them. So again, the IETF is not the internet police. If you want to do something different on your network, you can. There's no one who can say you can't do that. Now, you may not be able to connect to the internet. because the internet is this network that has sort of agreed on all of these things. But if you want to take one of the IETF standards and bollocks it up completely for your own network, go have a party. That's just fine. And the advantage of this, one of the radical things with this is, as an open standard, is if you do that, you may discover something that's really a lot better than what we're doing currently. And you can come back with data and say, hey, you know what? That thing that you're doing, I'm doing it this way, and look at these results. And then maybe we will, in fact, up and move it forwards. So now let's talk a little bit about how this happens. Remember I said that anyone could participate in the IETF, and literally you become an IETF participant by being on a mailing list, show up for meetings or anything like that. You can, but you don't have to. Anyone can actually produce the doc IETF publishes. And I do mean anybody. We get some pretty random starts sometimes. All IETF RFCs start their life as an internet draft, which we most drafts. The second bullet says you don't have to go to meetings. That is extremely true. Some of the most popular standards in the IETF were written by people who have never shown up to an IETF meeting. Some of the standards started by somebody who said, I'm never going to really be in the IETF, but I think this is a good idea. Other people who were active in the IETF took the idea and ran with it. Again, it's a very open system, so you can start something and don't have to follow it through. You can be the person who finishes all of this. But to write an internet draft, you sort of follow a certain format, and then you go to a website and you say, here's my new internet draft. And you have published an internet draft. Now, the flip side of this is some people think that internet drafts are these important things, when in fact, a lot of them are just barely formed ideas. And I've written some internet drafts that turned out to be like really, really terrible ideas. But fortunately, I published it. Someone looked at it and said, no, this is all wrong. And then you just let it go. You don't have to remove it or anything. In fact, one of the nice things about the internet drafts, you can look at old ones, you can see old bad ideas. That's really, really useful, because if someone has the same bad idea 5 years from now, someone say, oh, no, Paul already thought of that, and here are the arguments against it. It saves a lot of time. But really, if you are interested in doing this, if you are interested in technical participation, not only can you be in the IETF reading these things, you can be writing them. And I really mean that. Don't pay a cent to publish an internet draft. The document format that is used by internet drafts and RFCs is antique. It's the same doc format that we've been using since the 80s. So it looks really good on line print. You might be old enough to remember what line printers look like. We're going to be changing that in the coming years, although we could have done it before now. So the advantage of having it in the old formats is you can actually read the old RFCs. You can read RFC 1. Some of you are also in other standards development organizations. Like some of them have adopted like Microsoft Word as a format and such like that, and you've discovered you can't actually read the old documents because it was like a crappy version of Word or whatever. IETF documents everyone can read, and it's not like that they were so brilliant. It was because they were so simple. We will be having more modern-looking documents within a year or so, and I've been active on that project. The nice thing is you go to the RFC repository. You can read all of the standards, and they're very easy to read, but other than the technical content. Once an internet draft, I'll go through in a couple of slides how internet drafts progress, but the end result, so as I said, internet drafts keep getting revised. Once something is published as an RFC, it is no longer revised. You might revise the RFC, you might have an idea, but the old RFC will stay around. So for example, SMTP, the way that we send email around, the original SMTP RFCs, you can still go read, but there are also newer ones that obsolete the old ones. So you can this slide sort of shows you how many RFCs are getting published year by year, and the two arrows there are just sort of to give you a historical perspective. You'll notice that a whole bunch of RFCs were published actually before the IETF even existed. The RFC series is not part of the IETF. It's a standalone series that was begun by researchers very early on in NetWare as a way of publishing their stuff. The IETF came around in about 1985, but you'll notice there's a whole bunch of RFCs published to the left of that. ICANN came around about 12, 13 years after that. And you can see that the number of RFCs per year keeps going up. Now, this is the total number of RFCs for everything. Remember, the IETF covers a huge amount of technologies that you are not familiar with. And I say that with assuredness because the smartest people in the IETF are not familiar with all of the technologies the IETF does. It goes down from layer 2 all the way up to layer 7. There's policy RFCs. We're starting to see a little bit of a downturn now, which I think is good. We don't need to publish everything that we think of. So let me show you a bit of some example of the RFCs. As I said earlier, RFCs are not just from the IETF. The IAB, which I'll describe in a bit, also has some. So RFC 1034 and 5 is the description of the DNS, of domain names. I think most people are here for the DNS part of ICANN. So those are really, really old. But you know what? They are still the standard. You can read them. You can find mistakes in them, such like that. RFC 1591, which came many years later, described the DNS as a system, how we have this hierarchy, not just the little technical details of how things work, hierarchy. Few years later, the IAB realized that, and for those of you who have been around for maybe 20, 25 years in this field, you will remember that some people said, oh, we don't need to have one root, we can have separate roots, which of course is a completely stupid idea if you think about it, because then there will be a lot of contention. And the IAB said, nah, you know, so that's a policy document saying this is why you want to have exactly one root. Some of you are concerned with who is, you know, and so see, the who is spec is also quite old. DNSSEC came a few years later. Those documents, if you are security people, definitely try to read them. They are long, they are very, very difficult to read. And they are the absolute minimum that needs to be said in order to protect DNS the way that we protect it. Internationalized domain names. So here's an example, the RFCs 5890 through 5895. That's actually the second round on internationalized domain names. The first round was approximately RFC 39-something. When the IETF first developed internationalized domain names in 2003, came up with a specification that still worked pretty well, but it had, once it was out and operational, people discovered that it wasn't exactly what we wanted. So 6 or 7 years later, they published new ones. So the old RFCs are still around. For example, ICANN follows the newer ones. So these are called IDNA 2008. And these are near and dear to me because I actually am the co-author on many of the original ones and some of these. So if you're interested in internationalized domain names, I love them. But this is an example of how you can still go back and see the original specs. Many standards organizations hide their original specs that they are no longer doing. For example, the ITU. If you go and look for old ITU specs for things that they advise, you literally cannot buy them. And since they have very restrictive copyrights, if you find copies of them, you're not supposed to distribute them. IETF is completely the opposite. You want to see our old mistakes? No problem. A couple of other things I can sort of skip over this. Actually, the last one, let me just make a point. We keep talking about DNS and ICANN-ish things. HTTP, the web, the thing that drives the web. HTTP-1 was standardized in 1996-7 or so. HTTP-2 was standardized this year. That's a pretty long time for such an important change. But what's important here is lots of people are still running HTTP-1, even though the new cool spec is out now. You can still go not only find the old spec, you can actually have both of them work at the same time. It took a really long time for people to say, this is important. I mean, they knew it was important. And here is the exact set of changes we want. But now we have HTTP2, and some of you may have noticed that because the web is running faster already. Actually, this is sort of a repeat of what I showed you before. It's a recap of earlier slides. The most important part here is that last line, the rough consensus and running. Rough consensus is really, really important because we're not a membership organization. That is, we are a participation organization. I'm saying IETF here. Anyone can participate. So as you are here at ICANN, you will notice that in some parts of ICANN, there is decisions are made by a restricted group of people, and in other parts it's completely open. That's following the old IETF spec. So here we have, just to show that as the internet got more popular, so did going to IETF meetings. At our height, which was just before the first dot-com crash in 2001, about 2,800. Now, compare that to ICANN, which started right around then. Remember, you saw those of you who went to welcome this morning, you saw that sort of chart going up of ICANN stuff. The IETF now has pretty much at steady state about 1,200 people per meeting. And again, it meets three times a year, like ICANN sort of copied the IETF that in different parts of the world, although the IETF tends not to go as far afield as ICANN does. We mostly meet in places where there are a fair number of engineers because people, it's harder to get to an IETF meeting for many people. They're paying for their own travel more and such like that, so we tend to meet in larger cities. But IETF meetings are smaller than ICANN meetings, and part of that is because IETF meetings have very, very little politics and process going on. It's really technical people. Many people coming to an IETF come for meetings, like two or three meetings throughout the week. That's all they care about. That's the one topic that they care about, care passionately. Other people go for that they've spread self out more, but right now, I would say it's likely we will stay at this level. No one wants more people to come to the IETF. No one wants fewer people to come to the IETF meetings either. The IETF is not one of these organizations that says, oh, look how important we are because we've got so many people. Only way to judge whether the IETF is doing its job is the internet still working, and is it working a little bit 5 years ago? If the answer to those both of those are yes, the IETF, the answers are no, then the IETF is failing. But in fact, if you look at sort of 5-year periods, the IETF has actually kept the internet working pretty darn well. I mean, they invented the internet, but in fact, the internet has not fallen apart. This is a good thing. So I was just talking about, actually, hang on a moment. I was just talking about work that the IETF does. And again, any of you can be IETF, and you can bring work to the IETF. Now, that doesn't mean the IETF wants to hear every one of your ideas for new work, because lots of people have really good ideas. I mean, some of you wake up in the middle of the night with this brilliant idea, and that you want other. Well, if you can't get other people to do it, don't bring it to the IETF, because the IETF works on consensus. It's not a place for a single person to push a single idea. So the IETF works best when the ideas that come in are specific enough for a group of people to identify they're in it, but not so general that it's going to take a bazillion people many years to standardize it. So there's sort of a sweet spot in there. If it's a very, very narrow idea that one person can do, one person should do it. If it's a, you know what we should do, and it's this big picture, the IETF actually does very poorly at that. Because sometimes people do get interested and try to do all of that, but then we never finish. So the sweet spot is, I see something on the internet, I see a way to expand it or to add some new features, and I think people are going to want to help me. That's where the IETF works very well. So scope is well-defined and not good. You also have to know when the work is done. And too big, the work's never going to be done. You're here at an ICANN meeting, seeing some of the projects here that will never finish. The IETF has had some projects that will never finish, and those usually turn out bad. They start off good, but then they turn out bad. Engineers don't have as want them to have, you know, 3 or 4 years, and they're off to something else. And the last bullet's very important. Bringing something to the IETF that really is just your interest is not going to make you happy, because people will start telling you to, you know, go away after a while. Not because it's a bad idea. People are perfectly happy in the IETF to say, that's a great idea, no one's interested, go away. You have to find something that you will have other people interested in. I mean, if you have a really bad idea, they'll definitely tell you to go away early. Many people come away from IETF participation dissatisfied because people were saying, yeah, that's great. We don't want to help. And so unless you have something that a lot of people would be participating in, not all that useful. Here, let me go back just for a moment and do sort of the flip side of this slide, which is when the IETF does a really bad job. And we have, by the way. The IETF has put out some standards that were overblown, you know, that tried to do too much. And when you actually implemented them, nothing was really good. The other thing that the IETF has done a bad job is assuming that people on the internet are going to want this feature without having really looked a whole lot. So we do a lot of things sometimes prematurely. The nice thing about the IETF is nobody has to implement our standard. And so when we do things badly and no one implements them, that's great. That's much better than if we do something badly and a lot of people implement. So that's sort of that hard edge, and that's why rough consensus is actually so important in the IETF, is that you will get to a place... This is where we are most successful. The IETF also works, the bottom part here is sort of important, with other SDOs, sometimes well and sometimes not. So there's plenty of other standards organizations out in the world. There's the W3C, IEEE, ITU, there's a bazillion of them. Sometimes they come to the IETF and say, hi, we have worked on this. We want you to work on this as well. And if it's interesting, that's great. If it's not interesting, a lot of these people get a little bit offended when we go, nah, not interested. Because they just spent a whole lot of money developing this. And the IETF, as you'll see in a couple slides, doesn't spend any money on this. This is all volunteer. There are some examples where we've worked very well. The W3C recently finished something called WebRTC or RTC Web. They ended up having two names. They worked with the IETF on. The W3C does a lot of very intense web technologies, but has a hard time getting things in, you know, like out in the world. IETF certainly helped on things like the security parts and such like that. So now many of you who have either Chrome or Firefox browsers noticed over the last year, they all have now these things where you can all of a sudden do the equivalent of Skype in your browser. That was from this. That was from this the work C and the IETF did together. So we do sometimes work well with other SDOs, but sometimes other SDOs expect us to do their work for them. And as you can imagine, for a volunteer organization, we can be very rude in saying, no, we're not going to do that. So let's talk a little bit about the how it is structured, partially because I've been fairly vague till now, and also this is another point where it gets a little bit weird. We have no members. The IETF has that many members. A lot of people show up to meetings, but you do not have to show up to a meeting to be an effective participant in the IETF. There are plenty of people who, in fact, have gotten standards published and who have never shown up to a meeting, showed up to one meeting because it was close to their house, something like that. But it is not at all required that you do that. So the structure of the IETF is a little bit funny because, you know, it's very bottom up, but the bottom is unmeasurable size. In the IETF, things are done in working groups. Not everything, by the way. You can have an individual idea that sails through the IETF with no working group. But there are about 120 working groups where most of the work gets done. So if you come to the IETF with an idea that fits well within one of the existing working groups, you'll probably be pushed over towards that. And that's very handy because 120 different working groups, you can imagine that there are lots of things that people don't know and they don't care about, but they care about this in their working group. So I might be active in five. Some people are active in 10 or 20. The working groups are all parts of areas, and I actually areas in a bit. Above the areas is the IESG, which I'll also cover. And so that's sort of the triangle of participants, working groups, areas, IESG. The IAB is off to the side. I have a couple slides on that. Again, remember, the bottom of that triangle is an amorphous group of people who no one can really measure. And again, part of that comes from the fact that some of the best participation in the IETF is people just reading mailing lists, saying nothing, maybe once a year, but that one thing actually is the thing that everyone who's been working on this for too long didn't realize. That's really, really valuable. This picture doesn't tell you much, other than the fact that, you know, the IESG is sort of over these areas. and the working groups are in the area. The most important part of this picture is you'll notice that there are no connections between all of that other stuff in the middle. So it's not like that it's a monolithic organization and this department is doing this or that. The IAB is actually not the IETF. The Internet Society, who provides a lot of the funding for the IETF, is floating over there. The RFC editor, the people who publish those RFCs, is not part of the IETF. So the important thing, and there's IANA, by the way, for those of you who are here for the IANA week. IANA is used by the IETF, but it's certainly not part of the IETF. Originated from the IETF, but none of those are actually formally part of the IETF. So let's talk, since Layer 9 is about funding. The IETF doesn't, there's no dues, there's no membership. People pay to come to some of the meetings. It doesn't cost that much. So you probably notice here your registration cost for ICANN is zero. That's pretty radical. IETF meetings is about $700 to go to, which is actually still very low if you compare it to lots of other things. The rest of the money comes from ISOC, the Internet Society. If you're not familiar with ISOC, please become familiar with ISOC. It is the greatest organization in the world. It is one of the reasons that the Internet is not just technical these days. ISOC was formed in 1994, I want to say. And basically it started up because the U.S. government had been funding the IETF work, and then somebody decided to stop funding the IETF work, and they're like, well, and that was just before the Internet was about to take off. So ISOC was formed. It's a nonprofit. It's a normal NGO. Lots of companies contributed. There's a million individual members. They've got chapters everywhere. And so one of ISOC's ISOC's mission is to make the Internet work for everybody. And in order for that to happen, the Internet needs to exist and work. And so that's why ISOC funds the IETF. This is my only slide on ISOC, but like I said, not familiar with ISOC. In fact, I think they have a booth downstairs, maybe. Or if not, there's certainly some ISOC people around. Get to know ISOC. It costs $0 to join ISOC. I mean, although they certainly like contribution. Great. And they are the reason that the IETF continues to exist. The Internet Architecture Board is off to the side from the IETF. It's sort of considered to be an adjunct. Instead of looking at how, what standards are needed and such like that, the IAB looks at the big picture. What should we be thinking about for the next 5 years? They also do some very, remember I said before, the IETF works with a lot of other standards organizations. And most standards organizations freak out when they look at the IETF because they say, well, we want to talk to the president. And it's like, we don't have a president. Well, let's talk to your board of directors. Well, we don't have a board of directors. So they want to have a liaison relationship with somebody. So the IAB takes on the liaison. Bless them for doing that. I mean, it's really funny when you read these letters from some of these standards organizations. It's this whole formal thing, and they're asking for one little thing, and the IAB writes back a three-paragraph message that looks like it's really important. It says, yes. So two things that the IAB also does that's very important, that is important for the whole structure of how the IETF works is, one, they are the ones who deal with ICANN about the IANA. So the IANA, and I won't go into a lot of IANA, he'll probably be hearing that plenty this week. IANA started well before the IETF existed. And even after the IETF had started up, there was an IETF fairly close relationship with IANA. So I'll have some slides on it later. But currently, and this has been true for about the last 15 years, is that ICANN is providing the IANA function. And one of the very important parts of the IANA function is what the IETF uses. And so the IETF has an SLA with ICANN for IANA, and the IAB takes care of that. The other thing the IAB does, which is very important, they are the overseers of the RFC series. Now, they are very, very loose over. They don't say, publish this, don't publish this. Pretty much the RFC series runs very well by itself. Millions of or hundreds of documents are published. You might have seen in the slide this morning, already this year, 275 new RFCs. But you want some sort of continuity there, and that's what the IAB offers. So let's talk a little bit. The next three slides are going to be about the actual sort of internal structure. The IETF is split into seven areas. Application in real time. Applications are like web, the kinds of things that you might actually as an end user interact with. Internet, which is the lower layer, the way things are addressed. And we'll actually, there, if you stay for the session two from now today, we'll talk about addressing and such like that. Operations and management. So the IETF doesn't get to tell any operator what to do, but many times, especially after over years, operators will have discovered that there are best practices for operating internet services, and so the operations and management area is very good for that. Also, measurement. You want to know how much is flowing through and such, and you want to agree with people on how to count. So those are the standards that come out of operation management. Routing or routing, depending on how you pronounce it, you want the packet to work the right way. And that's actually terribly complicated stuff that I do not understand at all. When I start looking at routing, my ears bleed. Security, which is actually quite important. That's been an area that I've been very involved in the last 20 years of you might have a normal protocol that has no security. How do you add security to it? Or how do you start the protocol with adequate security? You hear a lot about privacy these days and, oh, we should be encrypting this or that. IETF has always been a leader in saying encryption should be there from day one. Encryption is important. Here's how to do it in a way that everyone can agree on. Because if you don't agree on how encryption happens, you will have no interoperability. IAB has been very good at pushing that. Transport is basically one of the most important parts of transport is how congestion happens and how to avoid it. So you're all familiar with, actually here in your hotel, you'll notice that everything's working fine on your internet connection over the Wi-Fi, and then just at the time that everyone starts streaming their video, it goes to hell. That's not just because the pipe is getting full, but it's because people are trying to get into the pipe. So, for example, those of you who drive on freeways, you'll notice that when it goes from four lanes to three, people become stupid, and they don't know how to, like, merge in a polite fashion. Everything they learned in kindergarten about sharing goes out the window. That's congestion control. And so that's very, very important because, of course, on the internet, everyone wants their video to be up first and such like that. So that's a lot of what transport does these days. Extremely important stuff, especially as the internet expands out to countries and regions that have less connectivity. Transport and congestion, much, much more important. General area, I'll mention a little bit later, but it actually isn't that important slide. So the area directors are all part of the ISG, which I'll explain on the next slide, but each area has two or three area directors. So an area director has multiple responsibilities. Of course, they're responsible for their area. So they are subject matter, their area. But they're also leaders because it's a volunteer organization with this bottom strata that you can't measure. You need to have somebody who is flexible enough to figure out how to actually do work. You also have to be able to tell these people your work is done. Because I'm sure most of you have seen this either in your organizations you're in. You're working on something, you get done what you were supposed to get done, and you still have all this energy and you want to keep doing it. And the work that you do from that point on actually gets sort of worse and worse, but don't know when to stop. You need some adult supervision to tell you when to stop. That's what area directors do a lot. I mean, they form works. They come up with new ideas. Someone comes in with an idea for a working group. That's great. But they also have to say, because the IETF is a volunteer organization, you don't want people wasting their time doing bad work. So at the point where they start doing bad work, you want the area director or the working group chair. Working group chairs have the same problem you have about, oh, this is exciting, and look, to tell you, stop doing that. So the area directors, oops, think that I could use the down arrow, but I can't, are all part of the IESG. That was that sort of top of the pyramid. Now, again, I'm describing a pyramid, saying top down. Area directors are all part of the IESG. They deal with the process. Two things really interesting here. One is every standard that goes through the IETF, and I have a chart in a moment about how that happens, at the end is reviewed by the ISG. It is reviewed by everyone in the ISG. So when I write a security document about to become an RFC, all of the area directors have read it, even the ones who mostly care about congestion or the ones who mostly care about routing. They all read it. So it is heavily reviewed. Very, very important that you've got good people who are not only good at organizing their areas, but understanding how it all fits together. The other thing that's important to understand by the ISG and, you know, the next layer down, the area directors, is that they also are volunteers. IETF pay, since there are no members paying any dues, they're not paying anybody. So now, being an area director is about a 60% commitment, 60 or 70% commitment, and these people do also need to eat and have families and such like that. So most of these, almost all of these people actually are paid by their companies to do this 2 or 4 or 6 years, but they are not being paid by the IETF to do this. They are selected by a nominations committee. I'll cover that in a moment. But they are, in fact, volunteers, which is sort of an odd thing if you think about that an area director who really cares a lot about this one area also has to care about the whole internet. You get a select number of people doing that who really want to participate in the whole thing. But that's why the internet works. That's why the internet isn't a bunch of little ideas that sort of vaguely hang together. It's because the IESG as a group has reviewed everything. So let me step back for a moment. Now let's drop back to the middle of the chart, the working groups. Every working group starts with a charter, and as you're familiar with from your own world, sure, that when you have to put together a charter for something, you already know what you're going to do. You sort of make up a lot of words, not really like organic, but area director's responsibility to make sure that you actually are following the charter, that the charter is updated when all these new ideas, and to make sure that the working group has enough people in it who are going to do the work. Because again, this is all volunteer. A working group that has existed for a few years, people might stop having interest. They might start losing interest, and yet the working group still has work to do. How do you do that? Now, the nice thing is, because the IETF has, you know, that working groups last for just as long as they last, if I have inspired any of you to become IETF participant now, you would come into maybe one or a few of the 120 existing working groups, and all of a sudden there's a little bit of new energy that hopefully matches the old energy that is leaving. Each working group has generally 2 chairs, and their job is to keep it on track and also to keep the energy up and to make sure that they aren't doing stupid things. That's job. They are certainly volunteers. Being a working group chair is probably a 5 or 10% time commitment. Depends on the working group. Some working groups take very little. Some are very, very active. Like, remember I talked about the WebRTC stuff now can open up and use in your browser. Those working group chairs were working really, really hard on that for years. But the result is you can open up your browser and talk to other people without having to download anyone else's software and such like that. So working groups themselves are actually quite important. The working group is in the middle of that bottom-up thing, but it is also still sort of a bottom-up idea in the sense that anyone can get a working group formed. If you can write a reasonable charter that has 5 or 10 other going, yeah, I would do that, a working group gets formed. You don't pay any money to do it. You don't have to have it elected. You know, it just happens. So let's talk a little bit about how things are done. I hope you can see the green line there. So working group or document, you know, let's say a working group is done with, you know, they've looked at a draft, they've revised it a few times, or an individual. So remember I said before, not everything has to come through working. I actually have an individual document that starts the process right there. You have to find a sponsoring AD. Now, for every working group, every working group has an AD. Say you have an individual document that has gotten a little bit of discussion from some people, and you can find an AD who says, yeah, that's good enough. We don't need a working group for this. We move it forward. It goes to IETF Community Review. At that, and every document that becomes an IETF RFC has to go through the IETF Community Review. So some people participate in the IETF without ever even being in a working group. Just look at the list where the IETF, the last call is happening, and they read documents in that last call. Some people do it just so that they can correct grammar in them. There are some people who like to do that. But other people will look at that and they say, oh, I've been seeing a couple things on that topic. They'll go and study the topic. Then they'll look at the document. And oftentimes, people who we've never heard from, had no participation in the development of the document, will come out with something really interesting to say in the IETF Community Review. One of the reasons we do it. Now, 90% of documents go through IETF Community Review with absolutely no comments whatsoever. That last 10% is really, really important because sometimes we will get somebody who's active in the IETF in another area or we've never heard of who will say, hey, this paragraph over here says that this is required. That can't exist. And everyone's like, oh,
Right.
We'll get back to you on that. And then it goes back up the other way, and it goes back to the working group. So a number of times, because the IETF is an open organization, that kind of thing, people are just looking at that last step. Now, it's not really the last step, because then it goes to the ISG. And sometimes ISG members notice something wrong or say, this is unclear or whatever. But these two steps, community review and the ISG, is the reason that IETF standards are as bad. Because you can imagine how bad they could be if no one was really reviewing it, only experts were reviewing them. People, you know, you couldn't read them and such like that. And then it goes to the RFC publisher for publication. So if I have inspired you at all to become active in the IETF, you could be up here in the working group, but you could even just be down here in community review. It's actually a really interesting way to figure out what's coming down the line. Actually, I think I can skip over this one. It's not so interesting. Basically, yes, you have to find need before you do something, develop a draft. So say, I think I've pretty much covered this fairly well. So let's talk about this a little bit, which is that the that review that I was talking about here, it is actually a formal review. So in working groups, there is almost always a last call. It's optional, but pretty much everyone has last calls. That is a time where it could be that a document looks just fine, but no one cares. You know, it really turned out to be the two authors who cared about it the most. That document is likely to die, not to be moved forwards. So remember I was talking about rough consensus. Part of rough consensus involves actually having enough people who have said, I've read this document, and I actually think it should move forwards. If no one's read the document because it was too narrow or too hard to understand in a working group, it will die right there. The area director then looks it over, and then there's the IETF-wide last call. And again, you don't have to have participation in the IETF-wide last call. 90% of them don't. But that is an opportunity. The IETF-wide last call is an opportunity for people with other areas of expertise to comment and say, yeah, that was sort of a good idea if you ignore this whole other thing the IETF is doing. But if you don't ignore this whole other thing the IETF is doing, it actually relates this way. You need to go back and integrate. And then it goes through the rest of the process. Oops, I missed again. Little bit on the nominations committee, just because you guys know that ICANN has a nominations committee up. The way that all that IETF leadership is selected is by this nominations committee. A big difference between the IETF, the NOMCOM in the IETF and the NOMCOM in ICANN. In ICANN, the nominations committee is selected by people who, you know, by the various subgroups, CCNSO, things like that. In the IETF, the nominations committee is selected at random. I mean that literally. You have to have gone to two or three of the last five meetings so that you know the people and such. But so the IETF nominations committee is about 10 people, and maybe 100 or 150 people volunteer to do it. They aren't selected. No one says, oh, this would be a good person for the NOMCOM or whatever. Their names are put on a list, and a random number is chosen, and they pick 10 of them randomly. So that, again, is something that sort of differentiates the IETF. What that means is that the nominations committee within the IETF is really, really represented. I think the ICANN nominations committee has some good representation because it's coming from some of the things. The IETF one, you're guaranteed it's going to be representative because you were chosen by a random number. They choose all of the leadership. So the area directors and the IAB membership is a two-year process. You get appointed for 2 years. Generally, area directors will volunteer to do a second time and maybe a third, so it turns into a 4 or 6 years. But quite frankly, if after 2 years of you being an area director, if you have not done a very good job, the NOMCOM, 2 years later, will throw you off, and that actually happens a reasonable amount of time. Not so much. It's not like that. It's a super hard test or anything. But in fact, we have area directors who come on. And generally the reason they get thrown off the IESB is because they haven't been as general enough, that they're spending all the time on their area, not helping the whole IETF and therefore the whole internet. And then the last bit is that there's confirmation from the NOMCOM stuff, but that's just rarely does the confirmation reverse anything. That's sort of a sanity check just to make sure a NOMCOM, which was chosen by random numbers, don't. So let's spend the last few minutes before I take questions, I absolutely will have time for questions, talking about where the IETF and ICANN have a reasonable amount of overlap. As I said earlier, IANA preceded even the IETF. As the IETF is making these protocols, a lot of protocols have parameters that you want have everybody agree on the numbers. And so those are registered somewhere. They're written up in the RFC. You can't expect everyone to find all of the RFCs on a certain topic. You want to have the parameters registered somewhere, and that is IANA. When IANA started originally, it was also considered an extremely weird thing because most people only registered parameters in documents that were copyrighted that no one could see or you had to pay money to get. IANA registry, completely open. IANA does things other than the protocol parameter registry, such as running the top of root, which used to be considered a parameter before it got terribly important. But so for the last 15 years that ICANN has existed, since ICANN pays for IANA as part of, you know, ICANN existing is somewhat based on IANA existing. Function between the agreement between ICANN and the IETF has covered this. Now, I want to point out this says for 15 years that this has happened. For 20 years before that 15 years, IANA still existed. It was mostly one person or one person and an assistant who was doing it on various contracts, some federal government contract, some educational contract. So we're really only talking about the formal IANA since ICANN started here. So once there was an agreement between IETF and ICANN, and this happened as ICANN was formed. It's not like ICANN was formed and then this was figured out. There was this agreement, and the IETF has figured out over time, oh, we want to have certain service-level agreements so that when we say, please put this new parameter in, that it will happen, you know, within a couple of days. And so those have sort of changed a little bit over time, but there's always been full agreement between ICANN and the IETF about service-level agreement, and both parties are pretty happy today. So here's a little bit of example of why you even need to have protocol parameters. So for example, sometimes when you type in something in your browser, you'll get back something that says 404, meaning page not found. That's actually a protocol parameter. In the HTTP spec, it says 404 means page not found. 403 means forbidden, meaning the page does exist, but you don't get there and such. So someone, you know, between all of the browsers and all of the web servers, someone has to agree that 404 means this and such. So that's in and you can actually look in the parameter registry at IANA for HTTP return status. So that's just one of more than 2,000 registries in the IANA set. This one is attention is paid to this one much more than many of the other ones. But for example, also for those of you who know about DNSSEC, there are multiple algorithms that you can use to sign your zone in DNSSEC. You don't all have to. So again, you need to be able to identify, I have signed my zone with this algorithm. That's a certain number. And that is another IANA protocol registry. So because some people aggressively misunderstand the relationship, let's make it real clear. The IETF sets the policy for what's in the registry. That is, it's not IANA saying we want the registry to look like this. The IETF saying we need a registry that looks like this, that will have entries go in this way, either like new RFC comes out or something like that. IANA is responsible for the implementation and for meeting the service level agreement. The IAB gives oversight to that relationship, although not a heck of a lot of oversight. It's doing a lot more oversight right now as we're talking about doing the trans. But basically, the IETF says what the registries will look like, and IANA says yes. And that has not been a problem. That was not a problem even before ICANN took over IANA. The person who was running the registries, John Postel, pretty much said the same thing. Was John was an expert on a zillion things, but not everything. And so when someone said, we need a registry, don't understand, his answer was just yes. So really, it's important to understand this has been going on for 35 years, and it's worked just fine. The last thing we want to do is mess it up. So I don't really want to do this slide because I'm more of a person, but I sort of have to. So I'm going to take a drink of water first. You'll notice there's only three bullet points here, and you're going to spend, some of you are going to spend much of your week within three bullet points on this. Great. I don't want to cover it that much. But basically, ICANN has a contract with the United States NTIA about IANA. And then, you know, in March last year, NTIA said, yeah, they want to get out of it, which makes perfect sense because the last thing you want is some government organization having to pay that kind of attention to that kind of registry, which if they did the wrong thing could really make it harder for us to do things interoperably on the internet. And so they asked for a transition proposal, and many of you are here this week. So here is that NTIA has had some say all along, but hasn't really, that's a good thing. Right? They aren't, NTIA would not be actually offering that much value. So after NTIA asked for this, this is the way that the IETF sort of handled it. There was initially, you know, the RFCs, MOUs, and the SLA. Then there was a working group. Remember I said that there was a general area, that last area that I didn't mention much? General area pretty much exists just to deal with policy stuff. So fortunately, they don't have many work. The last thing you want is engineers doing all your policy. Again, we have a short attention. But so there was a working group called IANA Plan that was set up with a lot of short, very opinionated people. They did their work. They came up with what they thought the transition strategy should be. And remember, I said every proposal that is blessed by the IETF has to go through community review. So go through community review in November of last year, give or take. And so there was the same last call as there was for this little teeny protocol thing over here. At the same time, there was this giant thing for the IANA plan. Community ended up agreeing on it. The ISG had to approve. The ISG did approve. So what I'm saying here is, even though this was a weird policy thing, it followed the same for everything. And then, so in January or so, the ICG formed. There's other input to the ICG. But this followed the normal IETF process. Now, the dates of when this is all going to finish change, and hopefully this week this all gets done. I would love a Dublin plan happen. And then that will go to the NTIA. The NTIA has worked very well with the IETF. NTIA is the same part of the U.S. government that a lot of the other technical standards work is done. So NTIA calls in a group called NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology. They work together well. NIST has been an active participant in the IETF for at least 25 years. I mean, they certainly were active in, so maybe even more. But so these are people who know the IETF fairly well, and I've worked with NIST on some of the security stuff, for example. So it's not just on policy. You know, NIST people, in fact, do work as well, which is, you know, that's the T in NIST. So it's also the T in the IETF. So this is actually sort of a historical slide because IANA plan has already done its work, and it moved through the IET process. So that's why most of the verbs here are in the past tense. So the IANA plan working group still exists. Fortunately, they're not doing anything. They're waiting for whatever the last plan that comes out is, and they will re-review it. But they aren't actively trying to do anything, and that's a good thing, because they should be doing technical work. You know, the last thing we want is all these engineers spending all of this time on policy work, which is not something that we're necessarily good at. The IETF cares most about, but not exclusively about, is the protocol parameter registry. So the IANA plan working group, you know, had the proposal. The government is going to have little or no role in it. That's if you want to look at the internet draft, the final internet draft. Now, the IETF also cares about other parts of ICANN. Even though we're talking about NTIA and transition and NTIA and transition, the domain name system is really, really important to the internet. And the IETF actively is working on improvements to the DNS. However, that has not been at all the focus because the ownership of the root is moving along just fine. But the protocol parameter registry is very, very important in that if the protocol parameter registry goes bad, we're going to have a lot of problems. So this is a summary slide. I've got one more slide with a little movie at the end. I'm right, so I hope some of you have been storing up your questions. Thank you for not interrupting me, because I think we're hitting the time exactly right. And so we do have plenty of time for questions. So the internet works. I mean, the internet exists for many reasons. One is because there's all of this out there that people are making money on. But the reason it is the internet, reason that it works together, the reason why it's not bunch of individual networks is because of IETF standards. Lots of people early on wanted there to be no internet. They wanted in networks that didn't work together very well because they could make more money by doing that. The IETF was a fairly radical idea that worked. I mean, we have the internet now. If I was giving this talk 10 years ago, I'd still say the same thing. If I was giving this talk 15 years ago, there were still people who thought that they could have little individual networks, and they were ignoring the fact that IETF open standards were already winning. The open standards process is extremely important. We would not have gotten anywhere near where we are today with a closed process. And if you look at some of the other standards development organizations that are very closed, and you mentioned, like, let's say that you follow one of them and you mentioned to somebody else in the room, they will not have heard of them. Most people have heard of the IETF, not because they would be participants, because they've heard of the result. And so the result is one internet. That was always the goal, and that's what we got. And we got there with open standards and got there through the IETF. So it's a sticker that a lot of us have. I'm going to show you, it's a two-minute video that ISOC put together. Oh, wait, no. How do I go up here? I go to this one. It really is just 2 minutes. It's actually sort of a cute video into full screen mode, and I go, and you might even hear it. Yeah, very good. It works. Cool. So it was 2 minutes, and now we'll go back because we have one last slide. Just questions. So, again, I'm Paul Hoffman. I'm the first one in case you weren't here for the slide. We have about 15 minutes for questions and answers or discussion. Russ Housley, who was the one who gave the presentation before, lots of these are his slides. You might see him around. He's happy to do well. Also, if we don't have enough time for questions now or if it goes on or you see me during the week, feel free to grab me. Always happy to talk about it. So Steve will walk around with a mic. If you have any questions at all, please raise your hand.
There's a room full of people. You got to have at least one. There we go.
I saw one back there. And I saw one up here, too. So yeah. We don't have one, but yeah. Please speak into the mic, because remember, we do have some remote folks.
Okay, thank you very much for your explanation. Is there is possible to know how many people from the IETF worked in private companies?
Companies?
How many people from Google, from Huawei, in order to know the influence of these companies where the IETF?
So yes and no. Yes, you can easily see how many of them are coming to IETF meetings because when just like here on the ICANN registration page it says who you are and your affiliation, it says that on the IETF registration pages as well. So you could go through and see that. No, if you're looking at the mailing list, because many people, including myself, will use addresses that aren't affiliated with our provider, you know, who we're employed by. So, and in fact, as Steve said, I just started at ICO. I still use my old address for a lot of my IETF stuff. So I sometimes have to remind people when they go like, oh, are you still doing that? I'm like, no, I'm at ICANN now. They're like, oh. So no, there isn't really that much of a match. To sort of generally answer your question, for example, Google has a couple of dozen people at the IETF. Facebook has one or maybe two. So two organizations that we think of sort of similarly, very, very different amount of participation. You had mentioned service providers. Many of the large service providers are very active in the IETF. Many, many people coming, especially being active in the operations area. Many of their competitors are not active at all. They're sort of riding on the coattails and all the work of their competitors. So it's widely dispersed, and it's very hard to tell.
So. I just had a quick question around achieving rough consensus. You sort of talked a little bit about it, so I'm keen to hear more about that.
So one of the rough consensus happens over time. It's not just when you would vote, then we all of a sudden switch into rough consensus mode. So, for example, let me give a real example that's in the DNS area. Somebody presented a proposal to the DNS Operations Working Group a year ago saying, here's a problem, and here's a solution. And the working group agreed that the problem was correct and the solution was crap. And so that document continued to move, but with a change. That came. Now, the author was not happy. It wasn't me, but it could have been me. The author was not happy with the second part because they thought up this really cool thing. The rough consensus part of that author knew that document would not proceed, that the problem would go unsolved if he dug in his heels. So there was rough consensus there. Then, at the time of the working group was finished with it, and so there was a working group last call, somebody brought up an issue that actually they hadn't brought up before, that actually sort of changed, not the whole solution, but a fairly important part of the solution. That another almost 2 months to grind through that. But again, the reason why it moved forwards was there wasn't an up and down vote, that it was this rough consensus thing. Once it got out of the working group, it just went through the ITF and, you know, no one else paid any attention to it. But so rough consensus is actually an over time issue. It's not just a when you might vote. It does come up when you might vote sometimes, not as much in the NS space as in some of the others. And different working groups do it differently. Again, it's all volunteers, so you can imagine there's a wide range of quality of working group. For example, I am known as sort of a rough-and-tumble working group chair. I'm sort of demanding. Other working group chairs are much more laissez-faire. They're willing to let the working group do work. And I'm not saying my way is right and theirs is wrong, but in my working groups, I demand rough consensus from the get-go. Other ones, it comes in a little sense. Okay, good. Please. Oh, okay.
Hi, I'm Jason Hines. I was wondering if you could go a little deeper in explaining something about the RFC editor. And I was wondering if it's a funded position. I think historically John Postel did it. And
yeah.
Maybe Joyce Reynolds. And,
yes.
Right, so I was wondering what's the status now and if you could take me through.
Good question. So, and remember I had said that the RFC series is outside of the IETF, but IETF documents are more than 90% of the RFC series. So as you said, historically it was John. John who was also IANA, John who was this, John who was that, super John. Right around the time, and John was leading the RFC series at the time that he died in 1998. After that, the RFC series, and John was funded, like I said, by various things. He was a researcher, so he had some academic funding, some federal funding, blah, blah, blah. ISOC stepped in and said, look, the RFC series is really, really important. And so ISOC started funding the RFC series. Now, you mentioned Joyce Reynolds. Joyce continued to do that for a bit. But then it became a formal contract. So every 5 years, the contract for who is going to be the RFC series editor, it's a group of maybe five people or so. Comes up for renewal. I forget if it's up for renewal this year or if it was last year, but I think we're at about the 5 year. And so it's a professional organization. There is also someone who's called the RFC series editor who doesn't work with them. They sort of oversee that. She's on a 2 year contract for every 2 years or so. So certainly ISOC has always believed that the RFC series is very, very important, and I don't think that there's any question about long-term funding of it, even though you saw those numbers going still way up. I believe the RFC series will be around for a while. I mean, again, nice thing is if the RFC series ended today, we still have no problem with everyone finding the RFC series, you know, that it's around, there's a zillion copies everywhere. But did that answer your question? Oh, and before we get to the next question, I'll just pretend I'm Steve. So we would love feedback. Some people like the way I give presentations. Some don't. Please go here. And it's a fairly short thing. So, yes, please.
My name is Jon Thoralsson, and I'm from Secua. Thank you very much for helping me to gain some understanding of this organization. It has always been sort of a mystery and a maze to me.
Oh, it still is.
But I have one question. You speak about one internet.
Yes.
Sort of a global internet. And from the media, we hear that certain countries like Russia, China, some Arabic states think about having their own internet. How does this work together?
It doesn't work together. Those are mostly reporters who haven't heard my talk about one internet. Or more seriously, those are reporters who have not talked to ISOC, because ISOC does a wonderful job of educating journalists about what the internet is and is not. So when someone says, and I won't, I'll make up a country name, Donia. He laughed. Do you recognize Donia? Very good. From the Marx Brothers. Fredonia decides that they want their own internet. What they generally mean is they want to censor some of the content on the internet. They want to use all the internet standards to make it work. They still want to use web browsers. They still want to use the DNS. But they want to censor some of the content. Now, some of that censorship will even affect here in ICANN because a name has content, right? You know, names are incredibly important to people, and they have a content value. So if you think of an organization that has a name of, you know, domain name that describes the organization, but that organization would be banned in a certain country, the name itself is somewhat inflammatory. So when they say they want their own internet, what they mean is they want to use our internet, but they want to scrub off certain. They rarely want to add their own, but they want to scrub off certain. They want to use the same technical internet. And this has been true, by the way. This is not a new problem. And in fact, quite frankly, a country called the United States sort of wanted to do this quite a while ago when they wanted to say that no one could encrypt, that if you encrypted things, you had to use a key that the United States could get at. And the IETF stood up to that and said, wow, that's a really terrible idea, because if you have the key and you lose it, and some criminals get it, or some other country who you don't like, so this would be 97, I won't list the ones the United States didn't like, but then you have not only messed it up for yourself, you've messed it up for all of us. So, and by the way, the IETF sometimes has a sense of humor. So the RFC that said that this is a really bad idea was RFC number 1984. the RFC editor sort of had to bump the numbers a little bit to make that work, but it was very cool. But so when people say we have our own internet, what they really are talking about is content. It's almost never the technology. They still want all of the technology that we developed for, right? You know, that's a little free ride for them. But no, no, you can't have that content. I have compassion for people who want to limit content. I also have compassion for people who don't want to limit content. I have very little compassion for people who have spent so little time understanding the internet that they say, we're going to have our own internet, when what they really mean is, we just want to scrape off the parts that we don't like, because that's just not a correct statement. And again, speaking of the technology, really wrong to say we're going to have our own internet. Some of them might create some of their own standards because they think it's important, and they almost always back off. So a couple of the countries you mentioned, which I won't repeat the names of, have come up with their own standards for cryptography because it's their country standards for cryptography, and pretty much no one else has adopted them because they're not as good as the other ones.
I just want to add to that, too. There is a danger to having more than one internet, too, beyond what Paul just said, and that really highlights the importance of the function of IANA in them holding the protocol registries of unique identifiers. And that's if, you know, we described the separate network that Paul just said, but yet they still try to have hooks into the general widely accepted internet. And let's say they want to use this IP range, internet protocol range, that is used by an organization, let's call it Facebook.
But they think it's their internet, so they get to do the numbers.
They can make it up. So they're going to use these arbitrary numbers, these IP numbers that are already globally allocated to somebody else, and that causes these islands of routing misfunction we've seen it accidentally happen on the global internet times over the past couple of years, where an organization or a country or a policy-making body, a regulatory body,
or some dumb company,
has decided to do something, and they put in wrong filters or wrong IP addresses, and suddenly the global routing table has a significant impact on that, and we've lost connectivity to entire countries, and vice versa. And a country has impacted the global internet before. Okay. Routing is an easy example of that, but that's why we have within the IANA over 2,000 registries of unique identifiers, because of the keyword unique. You need to be something special in order for a protocol or run, which then allows the internet to run.
And just as a follow-on for that, one really means one. Yeah, one thing that the IETF has always come up with is when they say one, they know the difference between zero and more than one. So, please.
Hello, my name is Hansa. I'm from Sudan. Mm-hmm. First ICANN meeting, first fellow. So my question might be, it's a basic question.
No, it's not, I assure you.
I don't know how someone propose some, for example, adding security to some servers, mm-hmm. and his proposal accepted. Mm-hmm. So I can't imagine how the other process, how it's being implemented, and you know, you got my point.
Right. So there's a difference between proposing to add security, for example, to a set of servers, and proposing a new kind of security. So if the proposal is to add known kinds of security to existing things, it doesn't go through the IETF. The IETF doesn't, you know, allow or disallow. But if it's a new kind of security, and for example, in the DNS, up until six or 7 years ago, there was no security at all. And someone said, you know what? We really need to have authentication security in the DNS. No one has to use it. In fact, as many of you know here, many people aren't using DNS security. That was a new kind of security. That's the kind of thing that comes through the IETF. Once the IETF has finished their work and said, okay, if you're going to do this kind of authentication, this is the way to do it, no one is forced to do it. I mean, of course, everyone in the IETF thinks, oh, everyone's going to want to do this and such, and we're usually wrong. You know, it's a long tail. But at that point, anyone can choose to use it or not. There's nobody forcing anyone to, and there's no one preventing within the IETF. Now, some governments, in fact, do prevent people doing DNS security or from doing it correctly. And that's fine. You know, that is that government's prerogative.
Well, we have a question from online, and great. I'm going to call this the last question because we are out of time.
Okay, very good. And so before we get to that, don't forget to do this.
Yes, the question is from Pallavi. The question is, do you see any clear distinction in terms of technology area, in parentheses, maybe in terms of working groups, where participation comes from developing countries / developed countries? Does area of focus research differ?
Good question, and I don't have a good answer for it. I would say that I see more people from developing countries getting active more in the operations area, because especially as developing countries notice how much further behind they are than developers, that's not usually in the technologies available to them. It's how well it gets implemented. So in the operations area, you will see more people from developing countries, but also in transport, again, the congestion problem, because if you have smaller pipes, your pipes are going to be congested sooner than for the larger pipes. And so I would say in transport and in operations, you would see more from people in developing countries who have already seen the problems that are coming up.
Great. Paul, thank you very much for your time
today. Thanks for
listening. Yeah. All of you, thank you for attending today. We are going to take a short 10 or 15 minute break to 10 minute break to get set up for the next session, which is internet networking, which feeds back into, you know, unique identifiers and things like that. Interesting session. Of course, all of our sessions are interesting, so come and join them all. And we look forward to seeing you guys in the next session. Thanks.